My topic today is the Greater Middle East, and I will talk about it in its various dimensions, and then we will reserve, I hope, the balance of our time, as I like to say in Washington, for comments and questions that you may have either about the Middle East or about other aspects of American foreign policy. I will go as far in a field as you would like me to. Let me begin with the topic that is of the greatest interest to people, whether they care about the Middle East in particular or not, and that by that is Iraq. It is, as you know, the dominant, not simply foreign policy issue, it is the dominant political issue for many Americans. Iraq itself, this conflict, was a classic war of choice. It is not a war the United States needed to fight. It is a war the United States chose to fight. In my view, this choice was unwise. Others may disagree with that, or agree for that matter. There'll be time enough for historians to sort it out. I would simply say that whether you thought this war was wise or not, whether you think it has been implemented well or not, we face the situation we face. Or as they have come to say in Washington, we are where we are, where we are. So where are we? We are facing an Iraq that is part civil war, part failed state, part regional war. And given Iraq's centrality to the region, given its large oil reserves, given its geographic place, given the forces that are contending there, it is hard to exaggerate what is at stake. And the question is, what do we do about it? There are those situations that, if simply left alone, will sort themselves out or even get better. Alas, this is not one of them. Not everything in life is a good bottle of wine, which if you leave it alone 5 years later, it will be in better shape than it is today. Iraq is, alas, one of those things that will not simply get better by itself. That said, it's also not clear what can and should be done about it to, in fact, make it better. I would suggest that we have reached a point with Iraq where there are no good options, nor are there any certain options that will leave Iraq the way we want it, which is essentially a normal country. There are essentially, as I see it then, three options. One is the option that the administration has chose, which is essentially to increase temporarily the amount of American presence there. This is the so-called surge option. The hope is that it provides the Iraqis, the Iraqi government, the Iraqi people, the time, the space, the opportunity they need to essentially get their country moving in the right direction. That is possible. Alas, I do not think it is probable. And the reason is that the most powerful dynamic in Iraq today is not a national dynamic, but it is a sectarian dynamic. So what then are the realistic options facing the United States? There are three. One is to simply live with an Iran that is doing what it is doing, including enriching uranium and giving it potentially the raw material from which nuclear weapons are made. The problem with that is, as you might expect, given the inherent radicalness of this government, given the fact that it is a state supporter of terrorism, the idea that this leadership, one which is, among other things, talked about wiping Israel off the face of the earth, the idea that they would be in possession of the raw material of a nuclear weapon is not something that should fill anybody with ease. To the contrary, it is something which is alarming. So to simply, if you will, be passive and let this happen and say, well, if it happens, we can deter it in the same way that we deterred the Soviet Union throughout the Cold War, is a leap of strategic faith that I, for one, am not comfortable making. There are those who would agree with me on what I just said and say, we cannot allow that to happen, and we, the United States and others, need to be prepared to use military force to interrupt this evolution. I want to thank President Fernandez for that gracious welcome. This is my first time here, though I was born in Brooklyn. Somehow traveling these few miles was clearly beyond my navigational skills. It's great to be here. So thank you for having me, particularly given the people who have spoken here over the years. I'm flattered to be in their company. I'm flattered to be associated with the name of this school, of the former governor, who was also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Indeed, he was one of the founding members of my own organization. Probably not destroy all of it, but also that program could be reconstituted in ways that would potentially be impossible then to reach. It would also conceivably coalesce support in Iran around this government, and Iran itself would have retaliatory options. It only takes one to start a conflict, but it takes everybody involved to end one. And no one should think that an American preventive attack on Iran would be the end of it. But Iran would have instruments and options available to it to respond in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and throughout the Middle East and beyond, involving terrorism and other tools. So again, the United States would have to think very carefully about the potential gains that it would foresee coming from interrupting, to some extent, an Iranian nuclear program, and have to weigh those very carefully against the considerable costs, among which I also would predict would be a dramatically increased price of oil. Right now, oil is just over $60 a barrel. The idea of a price 2, 3, or more times that is not far-fetched in that sort of a contingency, and one can just speculate as to the national and international economic consequences of oil costing 2 or 3 times what it currently does. So what option is left? The option is left is to try to negotiate with Iran to persuade it to accept limits on its activity in the nuclear area and to accept a degree of international access to its activities in the nuclear area that we can live with. In return, or sanctions, economic and political sanctions would be reduced vis-a-vis Iran. Security assurances could be given, access to nuclear energy, if that indeed is a sincere desire of the Iranians, could be provided. Can I stand here this morning and guarantee to you that such a negotiation would succeed? I cannot. But in diplomacy, negotiations have two purposes. One is that they might succeed on terms that would leave you better off than you would be otherwise, either by doing nothing or by using other foreign policy instruments. But the other purpose of negotiation, of diplomacy, is to clarify, to see whether, in fact, that option is available. If not, you are then in a better position to weigh the pros and cons of the alternatives. So again, I can't guarantee that a negotiation, no matter how designed vis-a-vis Iran, would succeed. That is in part up to the Iranians, what it is they are prepared to agree to. But what I can say with confidence is that the other options are not attractive, and that it behooves the United States and the international community to explore fully the diplomatic option, and then, if it turns out not to be available on terms we can live with, then we could consider with clarity the pros and cons of the alternatives. Our third challenge in the Middle East, beyond Iraq, beyond Iran, is that which is perhaps the most familiar, I would think, to people sitting here today, which is that involving Israel, the Palestinians, and Syria. Essentially what we used to call the peace process, the Arab-Israeli conflict, what have you. When it comes to Israelis and Palestinians, which is in many ways the core of this conflict, one which, by the way, this June we will mark the 40th anniversary of the June 1967 war, so this is one that is painfully familiar, shall we say. We are not at a moment where I am confident that negotiations could succeed. Negotiations require not simply a formula for compromise, not simply a process, but negotiations anywhere, require leadership representing the protagonist. It requires leadership that is both willing and able to compromise. And by that I mean prepared to make the compromises, that are necessary, and then is able to politically sell them to their respective domestic constituencies. So it takes both some flexibility and strength for a negotiation to succeed, a will and a capacity. I do not believe that that will and capacity are present right now on the Israeli-Palestinian front. And that as a result, to simply proceed as if it did would be the equivalent of banging your head against the wall. In my experience, the wall fares better than your head. What's interesting about the Middle East, though, and this particular dispute, is that many of the basic ideas of any conceivable agreement are out there. What's missing is not the general outlines of a plan, in my view. It would obviously have to have large territorial dimensions, where Israel would have to return territory based upon the 1967 lines. There would then have to be deviations from that in order to take into account legitimate Israeli security concerns, demographic realities. There would then, I believe, have to be a degree of compensation territorially for where those deviations were. Palestinian refugees would not be able to be resettled in Israel, but rather would, in my view, have to be resettled in the state of Palestine if they chose to do that. There would have to be some arrangement on holy places in Jerusalem and on Jerusalem itself. There would have to be considerable financial assistance to the Palestinians. There would have to be expressions of a mutual willingness to live in peace, and so forth. But again, we can't get from here to there because we do not have leadership on the respective sides willing and able to sign on to these ideas. What I have been advocating, and I believe should be done, is that in this situation, what the United States should try to do is get to the point where negotiations might succeed. Or to put it another way, we are in a situation of pre-negotiations, and the goal ought to be to ripen the situation so that traditional diplomacy might actually work. What I have been advocating is that the president uses a bully pulpit and the president of the United States go out and articulate American support along the lines of what I've just described as the American position on what we believe would be a fair and reasonable and practical solution to the Israeli-Palestinian problem in a way that an outcome that would leave all the parties far better off than they are today. And what I am hoping is that on the Palestinian side, this would then trigger a fundamental debate. What the president would do if he were to do this would be to essentially spell out what he means by a two-state solution, what he means by a Palestinian state. And it would make it possible for responsible Palestinian leaders to say, we should give up violence 100% because there is a diplomatic path that would satisfy us. And it would challenge those Palestinians who persist in using violence to justify why it was they were continuing to use violence when, in fact, there was a real, attractive, diplomatic alternative that was now available. I believe this could become the basis for an election within the Palestinian area. It may also trigger greater conflict in the short run between contending Palestinian parties. But over time, I believe it would bring a clarity in the Palestinian community. And based upon public opinion polls, I believe it would bring to the fore Palestinians who would support this sort of an approach to Middle East peace. I also believe if that were to happen, it would have a profound effect within Israel. And it would influence the trajectory of Israeli politics. All of this would take time. There's no guarantees it would work. But again, in diplomacy, one has to work with the situation one has, to borrow a phrase I used a few minutes ago, in a very different situation. We are where we are where we are. This is where we now are in this long-standing dispute. And what the United States needs to do is to try to change the momentum of it because, again, this is not one of those disputes that I believe, if left to its own devices, will sort itself out. To the contrary, where over the last 6 years where the United States has played a less active role than it traditionally has, I believe that this dispute has become more, not less, complex. This is not the only track in the Middle East when it comes to negotiations and the so-called peace process. The other involves Israel and Syria. And here, actually, I'm somewhat more optimistic, surprisingly enough. I actually think, based upon informal diplomatic contacts, that there could be the possibility of a negotiation here that could succeed. And interestingly enough, it will involve not just the situation between Israel and Syria, but indirectly would also help the situation in Iraq. And I could imagine a multi-dimensional negotiation where Syria would do more to make sure that its border could not be crossed by individuals coming into Iraq to practice mayhem, that the Syrians would dramatically reduce the scope of activities of radical Palestinian groups who are based in Damascus, that the Syrians and the Israelis would negotiate an end to their conflict, and Israel would return the Golan Heights gained in the 1960 war in exchange for a peace with Syria akin to the peace that Israel negotiated with Egypt. This may sound optimistic, it may sound, which it is, but it is not far-fetched. There's reason to believe that such a negotiation is at least worth exploring and that possibly it could be realized after months or years of diplomatic effort. Syria in the past has worked with the United States. They were the first country to accept in 1991 the American invitation to attend the Madrid Peace Conference, which was the first time Israelis and Arabs came face-to-face to negotiate peace. The Israelis formed part of the coalition the United States formed in 1990 to oust the Iraqis from Kuwait. So the idea of participation or cooperation, rather, with Syria is not without historical precedent. Again, I could be wrong. Everything I've said here could be proven to be overly optimistic. But again, I do not see any harm in trying. The purpose, again, of diplomacy, if it can't succeed, is to clarify. And I believe it is worth clarifying Syrian intentions. What else? As if this were not complicated enough. Iraq, Iran, and again, the disputes between Israelis and Palestinians, Israelis and Syrians, and I haven't even mentioned the problems in Lebanon. But what else is there? There's actually one big thing left, which in some ways is as complicated, if not more so, than anything I mentioned, which is not the challenge between parties in this part of the world, but rather it's the challenge within. And by this I'm referring to the challenge within Arab societies. This is a part of the world, the greater Middle East in particular, where essentially most individuals, I'd say, certainly too many individuals, have not participated in many of the fruits of modern life. There's an absence of democracy. There's an absence of market economies. Life expectancy is too short. Access of girls to education is way too low. Access of women to anything remotely like equal opportunity simply does not exist in many societies. This is a description of a part of the world which, again, is missing out on many of the positive sides of modernity, is missing out on many of the positive aspects of globalization. You need not take my word for it. Read, if you will, the Arab Human Development Reports, a group of reports produced under UN auspices by Arab academics, experts, and intellectuals. It's a remarkable series of self-critiques about Arab society. Clearly, the people and leaders of these societies have a stake in doing something about this situation, but so do we as outsiders. This sort of situation is not just bad on humanitarian terms, but I think it's also bad strategically. It creates conditions of instability, but also radicalness. Young men in particular who don't have job prospects, don't, when they go to schools, do not pick up the tools they need to survive, much less thrive in a modern competitive environment, when they don't have political opportunity in their society, when the only place in the society which offers an alternative to an undemocratic government is the mosque, This is a prescription. This is a formula for radicalization, and often radicalization is but a prelude to terror. So the need to see change in this part of the world, I would think, is overwhelming. Now, the challenge for outsiders is how to be an agent of change, how to be acceptable, how to be a productive force for change. And I would say it's probably the hardest foreign policy challenge I know. Everything I've talked about up to now is what you might call traditional foreign policy, dealing with wars, dealing with diplomacy, but trying to help engineer, help shape, help reform other societies from within is the single most difficult task I'm aware of in the business that I've chosen. But that said, we have a stake in the outcome of this process, and we have a stake in these societies becoming more open, these societies becoming more tolerant, becoming more liberal in the classic sense of the world. And this means essentially trying to promote civil society, trying to promote the rule of law, trying to promote better rights for girls and women, trying to create conditions where American and other companies invest, essentially trying to change the social and economic and political dynamics of these societies. In this, elections have a role to play, but it's not early and it's not central. We need to first create societies where political and economic power is distributed, where voices can be heard and can be heard safely. And this is a long-term task. This is not the sort of thing you measure in years and decades. It's the sort of thing you measure in generations. But as was said in a very different context, even the longest journeys start with a single step. It is time to begin these journeys in this part of the world because, yet again, these are not situations that, if left to their own devices, will sort themselves out or get better. They all argue for intervention. So where does this leave us? And I'll pretty much stop here. You pull back, it's an extraordinary set of challenges. Iraq, Iran, Israel's relations with Palestinians, with Syrians, the struggle for the future of Lebanon, the domestic and social challenge of the hundreds of millions of people who live in the Arab world. What makes it particularly tough is that any one of these is difficult. But also, what happens in any one of these is not isolated. If there's a setback, if there's problems in one, it could actually make it more difficult to achieve progress in the other. If you think of these four or five issues I've mentioned, they're almost like fault lines in an earthquake zone. And when there's vibrations and instability along one, it can cause sympathetic vibrations and an instability on one of the others. But there's also a more positive way of looking at it. When there's progress in one, it can also help create vibrations and momentum that make it less difficult to make progress on others. So it argues for trying to do what we can on each one of these, because if there's progress on any, it ought to make it less difficult to achieve progress on the others. But I don't want to in any way diminish the scale of the difficulty. Taking a step back, as we look at the 21st century, and here we are now about halfway through the first decade of this new century, the Middle East constitutes one of the three great challenges to American foreign policy. And as you've seen, it's a complicated and difficult set of challenges. The other two, just quickly, could not be more different. One is Asia. And Asia constitutes a fundamentally different sort of foreign policy challenge. I know several of you are students here of history, students of American foreign policy. So if the Middle East is a set of challenges that's largely dealing with, in some ways, the negatives of the status quo, and the challenge is to keep it from getting worse and hopefully to help begin to make it better, the challenge in Asia is fundamentally different. Asia is a part of the world of tremendous dynamism, tremendous prosperity, increasing individual opportunity and freedom, and largely peace. It is the part of the world where many of the great rising powers of our era, China, India, Japan, others, like Vietnam are all placed. You've also got Russia, the United States as a Pacific power with intimate relationships in Asia where we all come together. And the challenge for Asia, again, fundamentally different than what I've been talking about this morning, is how to make sure that all this dynamism is structured in a way that it leads to greater prosperity and continued peace for the inhabitants of the region. So you can almost think of it as an architectural problem in the political sense. How do we structure all this dynamism, to put it another way, so that 21st century Asia does not in any way resemble 20th century Europe, that we sort out the major power relationships in a way so that it remains peaceful and productive. And that is the great strategic challenge of Asia, but it's also a tremendous opportunity for Asia and the world. The third great foreign policy challenge, in addition to these two regional challenges of the Middle East and Asia, is global. And by that I mean the signature challenges of this era of the world and the signature challenges to the United States in this era of the world are global. It is what to do about climate change. It is what to do to maintain energy security. It is what to do about disease. It is what to do about trade. It is what to do about terror. It is what to do about the spread of nuclear materials and weapons. All of these are global challenges. And almost if there were a bumper sticker here, you'd say global challenges require global solutions. These are not things that the United States, despite its power, can do by itself. There are not unilateral answers to any of these challenges. There's not even regional answers for the most part to these challenges. There's got to be global answers. It might mean new rules in international relations. It may mean new institutions, or it may mean adapting institutions that were born in a previous era of history, say after World War II, and adapting them for a very different era, which is the one that we are in and moving towards in the 21st century, to essentially, again, make it possible for the world to deal with these global challenges, including but not limited, say, to climate change. And what I would say in doing all this is that the role of military force in all of this will be present but extremely limited. Again, these are not things that we can do by ourselves. There are not unilateral answers. And that they will require rather other foreign policy tools, in particular diplomatic, but other as well. But our ability to work with the challenge, to meet the challenge in Asia, and to meet these global challenges will in part depend upon how well we fare in the Middle East. So I end by returning to my subject of my talk today. The United States has tremendous interests in the Middle East, from the security and welfare of Israel, to limiting the spread of nuclear materials and weapons, to countering terrorism, to securing access to oil and natural gas, to the humanitarian welfare of the hundreds of millions of people in the area. And I would simply say it is a daunting set of foreign policy challenges, but it is not one we can run away from. If we make progress in the Middle East, it will provide a foundation for making progress elsewhere and seeing that the 21st century turns out right. And if we fail in the Middle East, it will make it that much more difficult to succeed in other parts of the world and to succeed in meeting these global challenges. So at the end of the day, the challenges in the Middle East are not simply pressing, they are not simply daunting, but they are also not simply Middle Eastern. They are also, if you will, global in their consequences. So I will end simply then with one thought, particularly for the students, when you think about what it is you are going to do. And for those of you who are interested in this field, if you choose this part of the world as an area to focus in, you will not lack for work. You will, indeed, I would hope that some of you will, that, again, it is one of the three great sets of foreign policy challenges facing this country, and these challenges are not going to go away anytime soon. So I hope that if you have not been depressed by the scale of the challenge, I hope you have been inspired by the just how interesting it can be and also how important it can be. Thank you very much.